Welcome to Unpacking Zionism, a podcast of the Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism. This is Yulia, and today we have a really special episode, and there are a few reasons for that. First, this is the last episode in our keyword series, at least for now. As we are wrapping up the keywords, we have a new mini-series in the works, dedicated to the movement that emerges out of K-12 schools in the U.S., to resist Zionist attacks on education. Second, the keyword we're discussing today is normalization. And I gotta admit that this term was the original impetus, at least in my mind, for the keyword series. In the past 2 years, since this chapter of Israel's genocide of Palestinians in Gaza began, we've seen many new people join the Palestine Solidarity Movement. And I was noticing that in many organizing spaces, people were needing concise, clear, and accessible resources for political education. Resources that are not watered down and that are politically aligned with the Palestinian liberation movement. And in organizing spaces I was in, on multiple occasions, I was desiring such a resource on the term normalization that I could share with new organizers or those who wanted to debate normalization, that would clarify the concept, its stakes, and its application in the movement. And while the Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism and this podcast do precisely that, we produce and disseminate knowledge and resources that are useful for the movement, this episode is the resource that I've been wanting that is focused on normalization. In this episode, I'm talking to an independent writer and researcher, Reem Farah, who wrote an article called Ottolenghi and Tamimi's Cookbook, Jerusalem, Israel as Frame and Palestine as Subject, published in Jerusalem Quarterly in 2024. In the article, which we'll link to in the episode notes, Reem analyzes the cookbook as an example of normalization and explains why anti-normalization is and must be a pillar of the fight for a free Palestine. Before we jump into the interview, I want to talk about the third reason why this is a very special episode. If you're listening to it on Spotify, this is the last episode that we publish on this platform. This is your invitation to find our podcast on other platforms like Apple Podcast, and we'll link to it in the episode notes as well. This is also a call and an invitation to join a boycott of Spotify. After this episode, we, the Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism, are pulling all of our content from Spotify, and we will not be using this platform for our materials. This decision is a response to Spotify's chief executive, Daniel Ek's $700 million investment in a military startup, Helsing. Ek has now also become the chairman of Helsing, which is a company specializing in AI-powered combat drones, and military software. Multiple musicians, including Massive Attack and King Gizzard, already pulled their catalogs from Spotify, and many users are canceling their subscriptions. We are joining this principled call to boycott Spotify over its ties to military technologies and manufacturers. So if you are now listening on Spotify, we're inviting you to follow us on other streaming platforms, because we'll be deleting our feed before the next episode is out. With this, let's get to the interview with Reem Farah on normalization. Quick note that we recorded this interview a few months ago in April 2025. Reem, thank you so much for being here. I'm really excited for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me, Yulia.
Can we start by introducing you? Can you tell us a little bit about your work?
Yeah, so I'm an independent writer and researcher. I completed my master's degree in migration studies, but then I worked in the arts, and I've been looking at that intersection between culture and politics. And before I wrote this review on Jerusalem, the cookbook, as a case study of normalization, I wrote an essay about tatriz, where my main argument was that normalization lends itself to appropriation, which is something that I've further explored in this piece.
So let's transition into talking about normalization. Can you start by defining it?
Yeah, the simple definition is the process of making something more normal. And in the Palestinian context, the term normalization is traced to the 1979 Egypt-Israel peace treaty, which stated that the signatories shall establish among themselves relationships normal to states at peace. And this is when the term anti-normalization is used in place of the Arabic term khiana, or betrayal. Since then, in 2004 and the founding of PACBI, or the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, and henceforth BDS, anti-normalization became an organized resistance strategy and centralized political philosophy. The BDS movement definition of normalization is joint activity between the oppressed and the oppressor that is not based on the recognition of the rights of the oppressed and does not aim at the elimination of oppression. Just as importantly, their definition for anti-normalization is countering this idea of a false peace with the concept of co-resistance, which I really like and I have to note.
As I was preparing for this episode, I was reading a piece by Yara Hawari of the Palestinian policy network Al-Shabaka about normalization. And she details the politics of Khiyana, or the pre-1979 Arab states' secret relations with the Israeli regime, most prominently involving Morocco, which clandestinely fostered relations with Mossad in the 60s. She writes that under King Hassan II, Morocco would also host secret meetings between Mossad and Egyptian officials, which eventually led to the first official normalization deal between Egypt and Israel. So the treaty that Egypt signed in 1979, establishing diplomatic relations between the two countries, sort of marks this change between secret involvement with Israel, referred to as khiyana, towards a more out-in-the-open diplomatic process that we now call normalization. Obviously, it's a sketch of a more complex and longer history, and we'll link to the piece by Yara Hawari in the episode notes. So before we get to your article on normalization, I want to zoom out for a second and ask you why normalization is an important project for Israel in the first place.
Normalization is important to Israel precisely because it is an anti-resistance tool of pacification. It erases the power imbalance between Israel and Palestine by offering to coexist or to share or exchange or partner. This performance of peace distracts from the systemic or structural power dynamic as one between the sword and the neck, as Hassan Kanafani put it. In other words, normalization is a PR strategy for Israel. It weaponizes illiberal politics, deploying soft diplomacy while ignoring or masking the reality of Zionism as settler colonialism on the ground.
In your article, when you talk about normalization, you start with the political recognition of Israel as a state, but then you zoom in on Jerusalem the Cookbook as a case study, and you primarily focus on the cultural aspect of normalization.
Yeah, and I think culture is overlooked as something tangential or in parallel to the political when it is actually the political. So if we don't radicalize our engagement with culture, and if we don't ask more of art, or if we don't hold art accountable, then what are we doing?
This reminds me of another keyword episode on cultural boycott with Palestinian drag artist, activist and organizer Mama Ganoush, where we talk about how if we don't take culture seriously, and if we don't understand boycott as a resistance tool that's powerful and available to us, that it's ultimately to the detriment of the movement. So let's actually talk about the cookbook. Can you explain how we can think of it as an example of normalization?
Jerusalem, a Cookbook is co-authored by a Palestinian and an Israeli chef. And under the title Jerusalem, the book performs a unified front or even a shared home for the co-authors. But it intentionally hides the reality of the city as segregated, fragmented, and occupied. The book thesis, if you will, if a cookbook could have a thesis, hinges on this idea of Jerusalem as a melting pot. And so it sells the dream of Jerusalem as a diverse society when it is a settler colonial society, when it is an occupied city. The authors wield the cliche that hummus will bring us all together based on food being the grand unifier, when in fact it is a major fault line precisely because food is entwined with the land. So this apolitical approach allows international audiences to vicariously enjoy a cuisine without consciously engaging the politics of culture. Importantly, Sami Tamimi's participation as the Palestinian co-author is a co-signature by a Palestinian to a narrative that erases Palestinian land and culture and appropriates it as Israeli. And to the uninitiated audience in the food world, this whitewashes cultural theft precisely because it is co-signed by a Palestinian.
Tell us more about the content of the book. What recipes are included? Is there a unifying principle to how they're organized and presented?
So the book has an introduction where it is sectioned off into a history section, a mission and vision section, and that is where the co-authors paint you a picture of their Jerusalem. And then the recipes, I think there's about 120 recipes, and they are all sourced from different places, some through Otelengi's network and some through Tamimi's network. But what you start to see, if you read closely enough, is that there's a hierarchy of recipes. The ones that come from Otelengi's network are cited with a first and last name and a story, whereas the ones that come from Tamimi's network are left unnamed, they're anecdotal, they're loosely traced to a source. For example, the charred okra recipe was made by Tamimi's nameless grandmother, but the parsley and barley salad was made by Tammy Rosenbaum, the mother of Yoni Otelengi's childhood best friend. So you can see there that the treatment of these two recipes is so different.
And it's interesting because authorship of national and traditional cuisine is hard to trace. But then the treatment of this question of authorship is really telling, right? It leaves Palestinian recipes to be somewhat anonymous, as if they're just there for anyone to pick, right? It ascribes a kind of universality to them.
On that note, there is a distinct overrepresentation of Sephardic food sourced to the regions that they originate from, such as Tunisia, Morocco, and Iraq. But rather than being attributed to the geography, they're attributed to the religion or to Jewish people. And the lengths that this goes to is just unrealistic. For example, hummus, which is widespread in the Levant, is said to have been a permanent feature on dinner tables of Alpine Jews who have lived in Syria for millennia and arrived in Jerusalem in the 1950s and 60s. So these are some inconsistencies that the book puts forth.
What is the vision of Jerusalem? And maybe we can expand this question to what is the vision of Palestine more broadly that the book constructs?
The book seems to be built on these cliches, as well as factual omissions and historical inaccuracies that culminate not in just an inaccurate history or narrative, but in an intentional liberal Zionist narrative. So, for example, the book states that the Israeli state managed to hold on to the western part of the city while losing its eastern ancient part, which has been densely populated by Arabs. This statement is wholly false because it was Palestinian Jerusalemites who were uprooted from Jerusalem's western neighborhoods. So with statements like these, and there are other examples of this, it's clearly written from the perspective of Israel. Another example is how the book muddies the demographic waters by referring to Christians in Jerusalem as Arabs rather than Palestinians, and also refers to colonial settlers as Jewish immigrants to the city. And it goes into really specific details about this to create this idea of Jerusalem as a diverse melting pot. I think it's important to mention here some of the statistics of Jerusalem. The Jerusalem municipality seeks to maintain at least a 70-30 majority of Jews to Arabs ratio in the city. And it does this through policies such as home demolitions, residency revocations, zoning restrictions, land confiscation. And historically, following the 1967 occupation and the annexation of East Jerusalem, over 236,000 illegal Israeli settlers moved into 14 settlements in East Jerusalem. So this kind of shows you how false the statement about Israel losing its land in the book is. But it also goes to show that this construct of Jerusalem as a shared city, it's almost the opposite of what actually happens and happened in Jerusalem.
Would you say that this omission of the word Palestine and Palestinian history kind of representative of the book's politics overall?
Yeah, what happens is that Palestine is erased. Although you are sold this idea of Palestine being shared within this shared Jerusalem of the co-authors, because the narrative and particularly the history that they include is so Zionist, Palestine ends up being erased. And this is where my argument that normalization lends itself to appropriation is so important, because it's a sort of eating of the other, if you will, where the frame of Jerusalem is Israeli or Zionist, while Palestine is a sort of part of the pie or a subject matter within that frame.
As you were speaking, what you clarified for me is that this erasure of Palestine, an erasure of the Palestinian history of Jerusalem, makes this supposed coexistence appear to be a kind of Zionist gift to Tamimi, right? As if here is the land and resources that we stole from you, and you are kind of welcome to some of it, a little bit, as long as you don't challenge this equation, the status quo. And it represents this kind of coexistence as like a goodwill of the Zionists, which really misses and misrepresents the reality of settler colonialism, racism, military occupation, and ongoing genocide.
Precisely. And that is the whole crux of normalization. Normalization is, as you said, this like extending of the olive branch, just temporarily, just slightly, to a Palestinian who would be willing to share the platform. But we will get to how the history of Tamimi and Ottolenghi's relationship is even more like acutely unjust in that frame.
I want to ask you about the relationship between Zionist settler colonialism and food more broadly. And maybe we can talk about foraging and also the idea and the construction of quote-unquote Israeli cuisine.
So within the Zionist movement, the social construction of a national cuisine was a stated goal. In 1935, there was an organization called the Women's International Zionist Organization, or WIZO, that sponsored a cookbook called How to Cook in Palestine. It was authored by Erna Meyer, and it reads as a national manifesto. It calls upon housewives to embrace healthy Palestinian cooking, as it will help us more than anything else in becoming acclimatized to our old, new homeland. So forward to today, and certain foods are used as brands of Israel. We see this in the appropriation of hummus and falafel as appropriated cultural icons. And Israel invests in celebrity chefs and in high-end restaurants, exporting this nationalistic kind of sentiment abroad. And this goes back to Israel's normalization as a PR strategy. But of course, the process of culinary appropriation is not peaceful. It's a violent undertaking that requires cutting off the land and food sources from Palestinians. And one such way is by criminalizing the foraging of certain indigenous herbs and plants from the land under nature protection laws. This is happening with foods like akub or white thistle and za'atar. And the Ottolenghi restaurant sells a pot of za'atar for £5, while Palestinians in Palestine are unable to forage for it.
This makes me think of Juman Amana's film Foragers and Rabea Gbaria's article, The Struggle for Za'atar and Akub, and we'll link both in the episode notes. But maybe we can transition into talking about what you call selective distribution of diversity. And you mentioned the overrepresentation of Sephardi food already, but what are some other examples of it in the book? And how do you generally understand the purpose of this selective distribution of diversity?
I'd like to mention the food writer Rim Qassis, who is also from Jerusalem and has two amazing cookbooks. She's written a few op-eds, and one talks about this overrepresentation of Jewish Sephardic food, as well as Israel's nationalist cuisine being kind of branding itself as influenced by so many different cultures. But she says that there is a vacuum in that kind of image because a newly constructed Israeli food culture that prides itself on being a byproduct of so many influences and immigrant forces fails to highlight the most important influence, that of the local Palestinian food culture. And that's what Jerusalem does. If you look at the whole array of recipes as a survey, you'll find that the influence of Palestine, the representation of Palestine, is almost taken out of the recipes and over-intellectualized or over-historicized inaccurately to cite and source other places and people. If we look at the Ottolenghi brand in specific, Yotam Ottolenghi himself has become an icon of new Middle Eastern fusion food in the UK. And in order to take up that space, he does draw on a lot of Middle Eastern foods, but he remains an Israeli chef. And in so many different restaurants that are popping up, there is that sort of thread of site-specific cooking that sells you this liberal ideal and what almost seems like a progressive, methodological, sustainable kind of approach to food. But in the process, it is erasing and it is rewriting the history of food, not only in Palestine, but in the region.
The way you framed it as a PR strategy makes so much sense, that this kind of liberal diversity framework allows us to hide the actual nature of colonization because, oh, we really care about the Syrian history of hummus.
Yeah, but specifically the Alpine Jewish Syrian history.
Right, exactly. So how dare anyone blame us for not caring about Arab roots of the food while completely and deliberately erasing Palestine from this history? I also kind of wonder about the timing of your writing about this book now. So the book came out in 2012, and I hope you can talk about its reception then and why it's important to think about it as part of the normalization project now.
Okay, so in 2012, when the book came out, it was hugely successful. It was referred to on food blogs as the Harry Potter of the cookbook world. So you can imagine the extent of that statement. The New York Times described the book's popularity as Jerusalem fever. And part of the credit goes to the book's positioning as this collaboration between an Israeli and a Palestinian, which made it appealing to this international liberal audience. But what happened simultaneously is that it threw off Palestinians and pro-Palestinian allies that had questions about the relationship between the authors, what their personal politics are, if this is appropriation or not, and whether the brand should be boycotted. There were no clear answers to those questions, and that produced a sort of paralysis in that people moved on or even promoted the book and the Ottolenghi restaurants thinking they were supporting Sami Tamimi. The reason I still wrote about it after all these years is precisely because it slid under the radar for so long. The normalization is meant to manipulate and pacify, and the Ottolenghi and Tamimi partnership definitely confused people enough, making it a very successful normalization case study. And I can't tell you how many comments I got from people just breathing a sigh of relief and saying, thank God someone finally wrote about this. Because there were murmurs and whispers and people just didn't know how to approach it. I was also personally interested in the way that normalization lends itself to cultural appropriation. And food is a huge part of that. So I really wanted to write about what I had done with Tatriz previously, but to explore it in the realm of food here.
Can you say just briefly what you're doing in your piece about Tatriz and how it lends itself to the analysis of Jerusalem, the cookbook?
So the article that I wrote about Tatriz was about its appropriation into art, not as a craft and as Palestinian heritage and one that is traditionally practiced by refugee embroiderers or female embroiderers in Palestine. It had entered that white cube space as something that's practiced as a fine art by diaspora Palestinian artists or otherwise non-Palestinian artists. And I was really interested in that kind of transition of a heritage craft to a fine art in the white cube space. The article is specifically critiquing one artist, Jordan Nasser, who has done that and is really wrapped up in a lot of normalization projects. He has taken residencies from Tel Aviv museums and sells to Israeli collectors. And he had made a statement saying that, you know, he doesn't need to boycott, or he doesn't agree that he should be held to that standard because he's a bridge between Israel and Palestine. And there was a lot of other pinkwashing statements that he had made. And I saw very clearly how that was a slippery slope and how all of these concessions and how he had worked, for example, with an Israeli streetwear brand where they were placing tatris on like baggy pants and denim jackets, but for an Israeli market, how he had opened the door for that to be used and how his co-signature had allowed that. And I saw some of these same patterns in Jerusalem, the cookbook, and in and with Tamimi, kind of opening that door to Ottolenghi.
I think that's a perfect segue to what I want to ask you about Tamimi's involvement in the project and how we can think about it productively. There is one thing that you write in the article that I think is really instructive in that regard, that, and I quote, "his erasure was the cost of his inclusion," end of quote. So I wonder if you can say more about what you mean by that.
What really helped me understand Tamimi's involvement in the project was a New York Times profile titled The Philosopher Chef that came out a month after Jerusalem was published. And it was a profile of Yotam Ottolenghi, where Tamimi was treated as a secondary character. So immediately it kind of reinforced that imbalance in their partnership. That normalization tries to hide, gives you the impression it's not there. But this profile revealed the extent to which it was. The article revealed that it was Tamimi who actually gave Ottolenghi his first job at a deli that featured Tamimi's Middle Eastern dishes. Yet Ottolenghi is the one who became the household name and a brand for Middle Eastern Mediterranean cooking in the UK. And of course, this is attributed to a host of privileges that Ottolenghi has that Tamimi doesn't. And together they opened restaurants and co-wrote books in Ottolenghi's name. And in the article, Tamimi was asked if he felt he should have his name on the door. And he responded, "I didn't have money to invest. Ottolenghi risked everything he had. A few years later, I became a partner, but regardless of the cookbooks we do, regardless of our friendship, I'm still working for Yotam. He's my boss." So the expectation that their relationship is or should be equal is built on the pretense of the equal partnership normalization markets. But normalization projects are always based on an unequal power dynamic. And this is what we see here. Tamimi conceded a lot on behalf of Palestinian culture in the cookbook. As the Palestinian counterpart, he was the gatekeeper of a cultural heritage and a history, and he allowed Ottolenghi to take creative and political liberties. And so this idea that you mentioned of the gift, Tamimi's participation being a gift to him, what it is the other way around. It is really Tamimi that's giving Ottolenghi all this power. Yet Tamimi gains only as an individual and not as a Palestinian. And this is a theme that you see throughout normalization partnerships, where normalization benefits the individuals or the participating organization only. It is self-interested that way, on the Palestinian side, of course. As I wrote in my essay about tatris regarding cultural appropriation is not a sudden overtaking, but a process that requires the complicity of its internal community, not only in approximating it to an external occupying force, but in devaluing the political history of heritage. Cultural appropriation is preceded and even predicted by a process of normalization. And I think I can say that this is what Tamimi did.
Wow, this is very clear and incisive. Thank you so much for that. In the article, you also write about what I would call a divergence that we see between Ottolenghi and Tamimi after October 7. What did you see happening in their relationship? And what is that an indication of?
Tamimi is on record saying that he and Ntelengi apparently never spoke politics and only focused on food. And it took the genocide after October 7th to change that for Tamimi. Tamimi's social media feed changed after October 7th. He posted graphic videos, and more importantly, he began to acknowledge food as political, bearing witness to the starvation. You could see the weight that that had on him. Ntelengi, on the other hand, he posted a statement about the Israeli hostages, I guess, on October 8th, and then made a statement about both sides a few weeks later. And he linked to, you know, like one of those dialogue sessions for donations. But he was otherwise silent about the horror that Palestinians are facing daily after October the 7th. I went back to see if he's posted anything since. And on the anniversary of October 7th in 2024, he kind of repeated this both sides are at fault statement. So there's definitely a divergence there. Now, I don't know how that plays in their personal relationships or in the Ntelengi kind of business enterprise, which they refer to as a family. So I can't extrapolate about that. But Tamimi went on to publish Palestine, which I saw as a sort of reclamation. But it is still published under the umbrella of Ntelengi. Ntelengi wrote the foreword to that, and Tara Wigley, the co-author, is part of this Ntelengi family. And Tamimi also just published another book called Bustani, which he did as a solo author and with a different publisher. I think it's out for pre-orders, but there definitely is a change in tone. And people have asked me whether like I would interview him or try to find out more, but I'm more interested in how this reads to the public, and without the statements and justifications and the inner thoughts, but what is put out there by them is really interesting to see at its face value.
Yeah, you mentioned Reem Kassis, and I wonder, are there other English language Palestinian cookbooks that people should know about and that you want to highlight?
Yes, so there's two cookbooks on Gazan cuisine. One is The Gaza Kitchen by Leila El-Haddad and Maggie Schmidt. And Leila has been really vocal about her family members back home in Gaza and kind of their, you know, updates about that. And another one is titled A Taste of Gaza, and it's by Lima Shawa. The Shawa family is also a very prominent Gazan family. On another note, I'd really like to also recommend Christiane Dabdoub's cookbook, Classic Palestinian Cuisine is the title, which came out in 2003, and it precedes this wave of English language Palestinian cookbooks that we see today. Dabdoub was the guest editor of the special issue on food and foodways for the Jerusalem Quarterly, where my review was published.
I want to circle back to the big overarching question and ask you if you could summarize why it's important to resist normalization.
I mentioned this, but I'll reiterate that one useful way to think about anti-normalization is to prioritize the collective over the individual. So while normalization is about individual gain over that of the collective, in other words, to resist normalization is to resist a fleetingly self-interested performance of coexistence for the tireless action of co-resistance in pursuit of a collective long-term liberation. In addition to that, I also understand anti-normalization as a decolonial project. So since October 7th, we're seeing just how grave the dehumanization of Palestinians is, and how so often the truth is not believed when we say it. Instead, the media asks everyone but us and only believes us when Israel or a Western party validates or confesses. The politics of anti-normalization challenges that internalized colonialism that implies that Israelis must validate Palestinian experiences. And if we don't lead that charge through anti-normalization, and if we don't challenge this, we will never decolonize our minds nor see liberation. That's how strongly resisting normalization is important to the movement, I think.
I really appreciate this clarity and big picture impact of what normalization actually achieves and how much it harms the cause. And that's the reason why I've been wanting to have this conversation, to really drive this idea home that anti-normalization is not secondary to the movement. It's central, that normalization is a red line. It's not up for debate. So thank you for this clarity. The last thing I want to ask you is about the concept of co-resistance that you mentioned in the beginning. What are your thoughts about co-resistance? Can we think of it as a productive model of Palestinian and Israeli collaboration? And can it contribute to the project of Palestinian liberation?
Yeah, I'd say that a power balance is very hard to achieve. And that is why I would say that the Palestinian party in a partnership needs to hold space. And that doesn't happen just by the Palestinian party demanding that, but it really hinges on the Israeli party or the Jewish anti-Zionist party kind of giving up the power that they have in order to allow for that shift in power. The term principled solidarity, I think, is really useful in thinking about co-resistance and anti-normalization.
Yeah, that's a really important thing to remember, that people need to have principles.
It just needs to be more people who have principles.
Absolutely. Reem, thank you so much for this conversation. Listeners, this is our last keyword, at least for now. We'll be back with a brand new mini-series. And as a reminder, we'll be back everywhere else except Spotify. So follow us on Apple Podcasts or other platforms. Until next time, solidarity from the Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism.